Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. There are a few people on the planet who know presidential history better than Richard Norton Smith. We know him around here as the founding director of the Dole Institute of Politics at KU, but he's also served as the director of the presidential libraries of Herbert Hoover, Abraham Lincoln, Dwight Eisenhower, Ronald Reagan, and Gerald Ford. You might say the man gets around. He's also written books on Thomas Dewey, Hoover, George Washington, and Robert McCormick. He's in Lawrence and Johnson County in the days ahead with the Dole Institute to speak about three men who made America: George Washington, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson. Richard Norton Smith joins us from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence. And Richard, if it's not obvious, I'm a big fan. Welcome back to Up to Date.
Well, you're very kind, Steve. It's always nice to be back. It always feels very much like a homecoming.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And, you know, when it comes to Washington, Jefferson, and Adams, so much history, revisionist and otherwise, Richard, has come out about these men in recent years, especially Jefferson. I'm wondering how your own regard for these three has you know, sort of waxed and waned over the years, or has it?
Well, that's a large question. It's in some ways that gets to the heart of what I'm talking about this week and next week. Washington, of course, I suppose I know the best. I did a book on him, as you
yes.
mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and I discovered that forget the false teeth and Sally Fairfax and the expense accounts. That if you really want to know Washington, if you want to humanize him without trivializing him, the best way is to follow him, in my case, during the last 10 years of his life, as a working politician.
Hmm.
He was a brilliant politician.
Hmm.
Part of his genius was to convince everyone, beginning with himself, that he wasn't a politician at all, which, when you stop to think about it, is exactly what this raw experiment of a country, you know, a nation in name only, required.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Was to be above partisan politics.
And we don't think of him as a politician. You're right. We think of him as something that's way beyond that. And you're saying that's part of his image, right? That's what he set out to do.
We tend to think of it, you know, the monument in Washington, I've always thought, is an unfortunate but apt metaphor. You know, it's rather chilly and utterly
mm-hmm.
featureless.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's just smooth and you can't really get a grip on it. And Washington understood that. He understood, I mean, in some ways he's a contemporary figure. He understood the theater of politics. He loved the theater, and he
mm-hmm.
understood that a large part of any first president's job was, for example, to travel extensively, to be seen,
mm-hmm.
to be this unifying symbol. But if you're going to be a symbol, then obviously you do have to stay away from being identified with purely partisan politics.
Hmm. How about John Adams? Because you're talking about him tonight at 7:30 at the Dole Institute over in Lawrence. He's often sort of sandwiched between these two titans, Washington
yeah.
and Jefferson. What about John Adams?
Well, you're absolutely right. He has for a long time suffered by comparison. He's a little bit, in a modern sense, he's a little bit like George H.W. Bush between Ronald Reagan mm. and Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
You know, very different temperament. But Adams is, you know, the funny thing about Adams is he's one of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is cranky and he is envious of his fellow contemporaries who are going to get all the monuments built to them and all the books
and he knows that.
About them.
He can
and
see
he
it
knows
coming.
It.
Yeah.
He knows it. And he puts it on paper, which is a very Adams trait. You know, the Adams papers are enormous and revealing. And they reveal someone very human. And so in that sense, he's more accessible because of his inadequacies.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, of course, was very lucky in that he married one of the great women.
Yes.
You know, in American history. Abigail. People tend, I think, to cut John some slack because they figure, well, my God, if Abigail could live with him, you know, he couldn't have been all that, you know, all that difficult. And they were, of course, they were the original power couple.
I thought Laura Linney did such a great job portraying her in that series that
yeah.
was on a few years ago.
You know,
ago.
I remember then, you know, in Abigail, of course, she died in 1818. And I defy anyone who watched the show. I mean, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. Mm-hmm. But people, you care about these people. And in part because they are accessible. We 200 years, you know, George Washington is not a man of the 21st century. Mm-hmm. We can find certain traits, qualities in him that you know, we can relate to. The Adamses, on the other hand, in curious ways, more than the other founders, it seems to me, really do transcend their times. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one reason why we go on, you know, being fascinated by them. David McCullough did Adams, of course, an enormous service mm-hmm. when he put his own credibility and popular appeal, you know, to work in rescuing Adams from that relative obscurity of being sandwiched between Washington and Jefferson.
Well, as he did with Harry Truman. I think he put Harry yes. Truman on the map maybe for all time with that book yeah. in the early 90s, because until then, Harry was still reeling a little bit.
Well, and of course, and to be honest with you, quite frankly, Watergate and Vietnam helped a lot because all of a sudden it wasn't that, you know, I mean, first of all, President Truman passed away at the end of 1972. But, you know, he'd been out of the public eye for some time. There had not been, up until that point, a popular yeah. book about Truman. But the contrast was drawn between the mendacity of both the Johnson and the Nixon administrations yeah. and the authenticity of Harry Truman.
Yeah. You know, going back to John Adams, Richard Norton Smith, he only served one term. And historians and the polls that come out every few years rely so heavily on this idea that any president is reelected to four more
right.
years. And that's a measure of a certain standard of greatness, might be too big of a word, but a certain achievement you have to have to rank
yeah,
high.
But Stephen, you know this better than most. The irony of that criteria is also something called the second term curse.
Absolutely.
You know, we've already heard people talking about, well, will Barack Obama be immune to this alleged curse, which is, you know, is more real than not. And it's not a curse per se, but it's a series of factors that come into play, including, you know, fatigue. I mean, the incredible saturation coverage that is accorded anyone in the presidency today, and which is, if anything, increased with the advent of the web, for example. I mean, presidents come into our homes more than anyone outside our immediate family.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
after 4 years, I you know, oftentimes, we're ready for change.
Yeah.
And it
yeah.
doesn't necessarily have much to do with their part, you know, with their ideology.
It's just time
it's
for
just
change.
They, like any house guests, they wear out their welcome.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so you have all of that. Plus, let's face it, and you already hear it now on both parties, people are already, it's a horrible thing to think, but people are already speculating about 2016.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so there's a whole host of factors. So, in fact, you're right. Many of the so-called great presidents have had rather unsuccessful second terms. Jefferson is a great example.
Well, John Adams had one term, and he had that. There's a great story, Richard, behind this notion that he just had one term. Why was that? What held him
yeah,
back
well,
from the second
term? Exactly. And the reason why his one term is as important as maybe someone else's two terms. And that's why, as you say, why he had one term. This was a man who, first of all, had the thankless task of succeeding
mm-hmm.
Washington.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And but then beyond that, he also had to navigate the royal waters as England and France were at war, and each tried to sort of suck the United States, this really powerless, you know, the army in Washington's first term numbered 600 men.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, mm-hmm. the United States was basically more of an idea
mm-hmm.
than a reality, and certainly a military reality. And so Adams, consistent with American self-respect, wanted to avoid becoming ensnared in Europe's wars. And for that, he, in effect, alienated his own political party, the Federalists, led by Alexander Hamilton, who wanted desperately to get into a war with France. Hamilton wanted to be the general. Hamilton wanted military glory. And eventually, I mean, Adams fired most of his cabinet. I mean, it split the party absolutely down the middle, but he was willing to sacrifice his own reelection, his own popularity, such as it was. If he'd become a war hawk, there's no doubt that he would have been reelected. But instead, he sent another peace delegation to Paris, and the irony is they worked out a peaceful solution. There was no war, but the news of that agreement did not reach back to the United States in time for Adams to defeat his vice president, Thomas Jefferson. So Jefferson, you know, narrowly wins an election that, if communications had been a little bit better, would almost certainly have gone to Adams. But
so no internet back in those days, eh?
No. or telephone or anything, you know. But 200 years later, with the benefit of time and perspective, and how other presidents have handled similar situations, we're in a better position to pass judgment, if you will, on Adams than his contemporaries were. And that's why I always say people always want to know, and it's understandable, they always want to know, well, you know, how will history see George W. Bush? Or indeed, you know, how will history see Barack Obama? And the simple answer is, you know, it takes a while for history to come into focus.
Yeah. We're visiting with a great presidential historian, Richard Norton Smith, who has headed so many presidential libraries over the years. He's also the founding director of the Dole Institute of Politics over at KU. He speaks at 7:30 this evening at the Dole Institute in Lawrence. He'll be talking about John Adams at 7:30 next Monday. That's next Monday night. That's next week. He talks about Thomas Jefferson. And a week from tonight, on the 19th at KU's Edwards campus, he'll be discussing George Washington. We'll have all that information on our website, KCUR.org. If you want to join our conversation with Richard Norton Smith, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Our email, up to date at KCUR.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, Richard, how did the other founding fathers regard George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams? What was sort of the buzz about these three amongst the rest of the crew here?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think it was, of course, Jefferson had his circle, his followers. I mean, the next two presidents, Madison, who, of course, was instrumental in the writing of the Constitution, and James Monroe, who was less well-known but a very significant player in his own right. And they were neighbors in Virginia. Jefferson designed Monroe's home. You could see it 2 miles from Monticello. They communicated by mirrors. And in fact, if you go visit Monticello today, halfway up the mountain, there's a little place called Michi Tavern, and the three presidents would meet there for political discussions and lunch. I mean, so it was very tight knit. You mentioned Adams, of course, being a one term president. The same thing happened to his son. There's something genetic about the Adamses and popularity. You know,
it doesn't work.
They can get elected, but they can't get reelected. Yeah. But no, the founders were as human as anyone else. You know, there was a tendency in the 19th century to turn them into demigods, which really robs them of their humanity. And so I think one of the really wonderful things about this recent surge, and there has been a surge of scholarship in the founders, is to, you know, restore them to life. Alexander Hamilton was probably the most polarizing figure. John Adams referred to him as the bastard brat of a Scots peddler, elegant way of referring to Hamilton's inelegant origins as an illegitimate child in the West Indies. Right. On the other hand, stop and think. Talk about mobility, social mobility. Mm-hmm. Imagine, you know, if a novelist wrote this, you wouldn't believe it. You'd say they were, you know, this is just over the top. I mean, but the fact of the matter is this again, illegitimate son who, you know, taught himself economics as a store clerk on St. Kitts and who found his way to New York while was still a teenager, enrolled in what today is Columbia University,
mm-hmm.
And became George Washington's sort of surrogate son, aide-de-camp during the Revolution. And then, of course, this brilliant, polarizing, controversial, creative Secretary of the Treasury, who really set up the American financial system. I often tell people, you know, we build memorials to Jefferson,
mm-hmm.
but we live in Hamilton's world.
Mm. That's interesting. And he's so often overlooked.
He is overlooked, partly because there's something vaguely gamey, you know, that sticks to Hamilton. Well, I mean, he was, you know, I mean, he died in a duel, mm-hmm. you know, with the vice president of the United States. I mean, and of course, he'd had a falling out. He said himself, he really no longer fit in to the young United States as it was evolving. He's not seen as a champion of democracy, as you and I understand that term.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he was, in many ways, a prophet. I mean, in some ways, a prophet without honor.
Well, Richard, if you could go out to dinner with one of these three, let's go back to Washington, Jefferson, and Adams. You could pick one of them to go out to dinner with one night. Which of the guys would be the guy you would enjoy spending an evening with the most?
Jefferson would certainly be the wittiest conversationalist. Washington, let's face it, I mean, it would be particularly for someone who's written about him, it would be a unique privilege to sit down and if he would talk, which I suspect he would not. He would be very guarded. Well, he was, again, very, you know, he was a cautious man with mm-hmm. a lot to be cautious about.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a hunch that you'd have the most fun.
With John Adams.
With John Adams.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, Adams would call a spade, and God knows he'd call Thomas Jefferson more than that. and he once referred to, you know, he referred to George Washington as old mutton head. not in public, but, you know, it's never been fun to be vice president. Imagine being George Washington's vice president, you know. So I think Adams, and particularly if Abigail joined us, I think Adams would be the most enjoyable dinner companion.
You may not recall this, but years ago, I sat in President Eisenhower's office with you out in Abilene. There was some event out there, I think, with Ronald Reagan. I think we had come and spoken, and I wrote a story, and then you and I were sitting in the general's office. And what struck me about that moment was that you, of all people, have sort of inhabited these worlds, these presidential libraries over the years. And I'm guessing that, at least I'm hoping for the sake of this question, that you have sort of gotten to know these men in a way that many of us we read about them, but we don't inhabit their worlds in the same way that you have so often. Yeah. And I'm wondering, am I reaching too far here, or does that make sense to you?
Well, no. I mean, I've been extraordinarily fortunate. The most, of course, the most obvious example of that was with the Fords, both. I mean, the greatest honor of my life. President Ford asked me to deliver the final eulogy at his funeral in Grand Rapids, and Mrs. Ford asked me to do the same for her when the time came. And
they did that. Why, Richard? What was your
relationship? Well, I think we had become very close, and I think you know, as you know, and maybe a few people out there know, I used to be a speechwriter, and hopefully can string a coherent sentence or two together. So, but I think, you know, they just, as I say, it was, you know, we were friends. And it was, it is, I tell you, though, the you take away from an experience like that sort of unexpected memories. And I will never forget, in the middle of my eulogy to President Ford, you know, if any of your listeners, for example, have ever been in a situation like that, called upon to speak at a funeral service, you know that it's unlike any other public presentation. And in a case like that, you're in a bit of a fog. And but I know I heard a woman weeping, and I sort of instinctively turned over to my right, and it was Rosalynn Carter. And I thought to myself, consciously, I thought, who in 1976 would have predicted that this is how the story ends, you know? And there was something very reassuring about that. And there's something, I mean, you know, I don't mean to be hokey, but there's something very American. I mean, at times when we all, you know, worry about the extreme polarization, you know, of our politics and our seeming inability into even in a civil way come together and discuss our disagreements. I mean, you could say it's a shame that, you know, it took an occasion like that. But President Carter, who spoke before me, had a wonderful line. He talked about a cartoon in The New Yorker that he and President Ford had both particularly enjoyed. And it showed a little boy sort of pulling on his mother's coat and saying, "Mommy, Mommy, when I grow up, I want to be a former president." which, you know, it's kind of nice work if you can get it. you know?
That's funny. Well, there is something, you know, about the libraries themselves that has always stuck out to me. And again, not knowing some of these men the way you did, Richard, but you go to the Eisenhower Library to do some research, for instance, and you sit in the library. And my experience has always been that, you know, the people behind the counter, they bring you your documents very formally, sort of one at a time, and set them down in front of you. And it's a very militaristic bearing about the whole experience of being there. You go to the Truman Library over in Independence, of course, and it's a completely different experience. It's, hi, how you doing? Here's, they stack up the stuff, and it's much looser. And in my own limited worldview, I've always sort of taken, there's something about the men themselves. I'm experiencing something about the way they thought and operated in the way their libraries operate today. And again, I might be reaching there, but I've always had that in my head.
I think there's something definitely to that. Each of these institutions, people think they talk about a presidential library system. Quite frankly, it's a system in name only. Mm-hmm. It's 12 or now, I guess, 13 with the new Bush Library coming on in a couple months. 13 highly distinctive institutions.
Yes.
Not only taking on kind of the flavor of the man whose name is on the door, but also of the community. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, go to West Branch, Iowa, and there's this wonderful, you know, world-class research facility plunked down in an 80-acre cornfield.
Yes.
I mean, you know, or Independence, Missouri, mm-hmm. I mean, just understand, or Hyde Park, New York. I mean, one of the things I think we're missing, and I'm nostalgic, the older libraries tended to be built at a president's birthplace or hometown. In other words, the surrounding environment became part of the exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had to go to Hyde Park, and I would say you still have to go to Hyde Park if you really want to understand Franklin Roosevelt.
Right.
Now, of course, they're all built on college campuses, and you can see the value of that, but you do lose something of the personality,
mm-hmm.
you know, of the influences that shaped, you know, that individual, his character, his outlook.
Well, speaking of that, Senator Dole obviously had a decision to make at one point in his life about building his library. Would it be in Russell or would it be in Lawrence, where he went to college himself? Why did he ultimately choose KU over Russell? Because Russell, as you know, is better than I do, desperately wanted that library out there.
Well, you know, I don't mean to be evasive here. I really wasn't part of that decision-making process. I came in, sort of a little bit later.
After that was decided, before they were
breaking ground and all. I can only assume, and it's just an assumption, that if you wanted to build an institution that would have a very strong academic component, that would contribute to and in some ways feed off of, you know, an existing, you know, series of departments and you know, just the academic climate, then it made a lot of sense to go to KU.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I'm sure there are folks in Russell who would disagree with me, but I think most people, looking back over the last 10 years, it's hard to believe. It's been 10 years.
Yeah, it is hard to believe.
You know, that it was a very good decision that he made.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with presidential historian Richard Norton Smith. We'll talk about Abraham Lincoln and the great library and museum in Springfield that Richard Norton Smith helped open. We'll talk about Thomas Jefferson and slavery. We'll get your questions to 816-235-2888 and our email address updatedate@kcur.org. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star. And you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation with psychologist Harriet Lerner about successful relationships, you can find that in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. From Kansas City movie theaters to Parisian salons, composer Virgil Thompson made a name for himself in music. On tomorrow's program, we'll talk with the makers of a new documentary about the life and times of Virgil Thompson. This hour, we're visiting with the great presidential historian Richard Norton Smith. He's the founding director of the Dole Institute of Politics over at KU. He's also led so many of our presidential libraries, those of Hoover, Lincoln, Eisenhower, Reagan, and Ford. He'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Dole Institute over in Lawrence. He'll be speaking about John Adams, but I'm sure the subjects of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson will also come up. Richard, let's move ahead just a little bit here to slavery, because, again, so much has come out of late about Thomas Jefferson and slavery. We had historian Henry Winsek on our show a few months ago about his new book, Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves. And Winsek was very, very hard on Thomas Jefferson,
right,
saying essentially
right.
No excuses here for the nation's third president, that during his lifetime, Jefferson flipped from being an all-out believer in emancipation to one who was able to justify slavery for the sake of financial profit. How much of Winsek's argument do you buy these days, Richard?
Well, I'm always loath to sort of, comment on the work of other scholars.
Yeah.
But let me say this. I understand where he's coming from.
Yeah.
And it is certainly a conclusion that I think many people would reach, that at the very least there is rank hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
And I would even go further and contrast it with Washington, who, for example, understood that it was rank hypocrisy, not just on the personal level, but far more important for this nation in the making,
mm-hmm.
which proclaimed in eloquent language its love of human liberty while enslaving millions mm-hmm. of African Americans. And so, you know, Washington famously in his will not only made provisions for freeing his slaves, but he specifically, explicitly, boldly broke the existing law of the Commonwealth of Virginia by insisting that they be educated, that they be given vocational training, that they, in effect, not only be freed, but be prepared to, earn their own way. And I think he hoped to lead by example. Now, in the case of Jefferson, Winsek is absolutely right in terms of the arc of his life. As a young man, he had schemes for emancipation, and that disappeared with time. I guess I'm a little bit more empathetic, and in this sense, not in any way apologetic, And Jefferson, you know, you can be very harsh in criticizing his actions. I'm just, as a historian, I'm more interested in understanding why people do what they do than in passing judgment on what they do, particularly from the perspective of 200 years later.
Yeah.
Jefferson famously said, "We have a wolf by the ears." I think, you know, referring to slavery. He understood that in a bizarre way, and I want to be very careful how I phrase this, he and his fellow planters were in a bondage of their own economically and morally. And I think the conundrum of Jefferson, I mean, I think Jefferson is much more complicated than the blanket condemnation. I mean, to be sure, economic factors came into play. But Jefferson was sensitive enough and learned enough and worldly enough and fill in the blank enough to understand that he was living this rank dichotomy between what he was saying in imperishable prose about Americans and natural rights and human liberty and so on and so on, and the reality.
Yeah.
John Hope Franklin, the great African-American historian who passed away a few years ago, I think about 101. Anyway.
Oh, he was in here once. What a treasure that man was.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Extraordinary human being.
Yeah.
I mean, extraordinary history of his own. But anyway, he took somewhat the same view as Winsicki. He said, you know, Thomas Jefferson was a man of the Enlightenment. He was a scientist. He was, you know, all of these things. And he knew what he meant when he talked about all men are created equal. And there's simply no reconciling the two. And I'm not suggesting there is, but I'm more interested in exploring the process, if you will, you know, whereby Jefferson went from that young, ardent disciple of abolition to the prisoner of the economic system that retained slavery.
Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. We're visiting with presidential historian Richard Norton Smith. Beth from Overland Park, you're on the air. Beth, good morning. Hi, Beth. Beth's not there. Well, you know, and yet, you know, Richard, we're talking about slavery and Jefferson and then the three of them, you know, Washington, Adams, and Jefferson, in all their collective, seemingly infinite wisdom, the three of them collectively couldn't get rid of slavery in this nation, which would prove to be so costly, you know, 60, 80 years
of
later.
Course.
And you make what of that? Why couldn't the three of them do it?
Well, you know, and to be perfectly honest with you, again, not to draw moral comparisons, but I mean, in terms of there are intractable political situations.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the terrible bargain that was made at the Constitutional Convention to not only accept slavery, but to give the South, you know, what it wanted to count these people as 3/5 of a human for voting purposes, which, by the way, is what elected Jefferson the first time over Adams, that advantage he had in the Electoral College because of people who obviously couldn't vote themselves. But just, you know, the moral stain of slavery.
You're saying he won because of the slave vote?
Yeah. Wow. No, he won because of the bulge in electoral, Southern electoral votes. The South got to count every slave as 3/5 of a person.
Right.
In the census. Now, none of those slaves, obviously,
could vote. Yeah.
Voted, but, you know, they were nevertheless enlisted on the side of, in effect, their owners. And that provided just enough electoral votes, that advantage, to elect Jefferson over Adams in 1800. So anyway, but the fact is, Washington, for example, who in his, as I say, at the end of his life, hoped to lead by example. People say, well, why didn't he do it earlier? Very simple reason. Had Washington, with all of his prestige and his unique you know, the only president twice elected unanimously. But if Washington, for example, had taken the first step toward the elimination of slavery, mm-hmm. even a personal gesture like freeing his own slaves, it would have had profound mm-hmm. consequences. Mm-hmm. It might have broken up the Union,
mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, was, as I say, a union in name only. You had basically three regions, New England, the Middle States, and the South. And the only way the South was going to come into the Union, the only way they were going to approve the Constitution, was if they were given, you know, ironclad assurances that this new country would not interfere with their peculiar institution.
Hmm. Back to some phone calls here. Beth has called back. Beth from Overland Park, good morning.
Hi, sorry about that.
That's all right.
I just wanted to mention again the John Adams film, the HBO miniseries.
Yeah.
It was profoundly impacted me on my knowledge of history. I always paid attention in history classes and things like that, but I never understood how close Adams and Jefferson were, and Ben Franklin and Washington, and how they all really had this love-hate relationship with one another. You know, I don't know how accurate that movie is because it's a movie, but the things that happened, particularly with Jefferson and Adams, that the timing of things in their lives, including their death, happened so frequently. It was just astounding to me. So I highly recommend it to anyone who really wants to learn about the Founding Fathers.
Yeah.
And I would certainly second Beth's suggestion. It's a wonderful film. And in fact, David McCullough, who's a friend, was, you know, he wrote the book on which the film was made.
Mm-hmm.
And he was personally delighted, because the filmmakers not only consulted him every step of the way, but in fact, you know, made sure that it was accurate, and it was accurate. And you were right about, you know, the fact is Jefferson and Adams had been best friends. Then they had this terrible political falling out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, thank God, in the last years of their life, they were brought together by correspondence and their letters. I mean, it's one of the great correspondences,
mm-hmm.
you know, in American history. And so they were. And then, of course, again, a novelist, if they wrote this, you wouldn't believe it. Imagine, you know, the two great founders dying on the same day, 50 years to the day. You know, I mean, it's just no wonder Americans believe that you know, the hand of providence was looking out for the United States.
Is there one president, Richard, that you think Americans, whether it's one of these three or any of the others, that we should pay more attention to, pay more heed, you know, to what they had to leave us over the years, one who's been underrated somehow in some way?
Yeah, that's a great question. A couple of examples. I mean, today, as a matter of fact, is a publication book for Amity Shway's new biography of Calvin Coolidge.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And particularly if you're a conservative, particularly if you're a friend of the sort of Jeffersonian, Reagan-esque, you know, least government is best government school of thought. Coolidge is an important figure and for a long time a neglected figure.
Mm-hmm.
And just also just being from New England, you know, I appreciate his Yankee, his wit. And he's a very fascinating, elusive character. So that's one for the conservatives. I'd say for the liberals, later this year, Scott Berg, the Lindbergh biographer, has written what will undoubtedly be a marvelous new 800-page biography of Woodrow Wilson.
No kidding.
Who was president exactly 100 years ago and who has been, in my opinion, subject to misrepresentation by some. But in any event, Wilson is an incredibly important figure in our foreign policy. Every president since has been, to some degree or other, a Wilsonian or reacting to Wilson. And so, you know, there are two presidents who deserve to be known better.
Hey, are you done heading up presidential libraries?
Yeah, I've had my fill. I told the last was the Lincoln, and I always tell people the trick in Illinois is to get out before the indictments. And
Even for presidential library directors, eh?
Well, you know, and also people talk about bipartisanship. In Illinois, it's bipartisan. The last two governors are in jail. One Democrat, one Republican, mm-hmm. Although the Republican was just recently released.
Right.
But I remember talking to Senator Dole when I was leaving Springfield, and I said, you know, I've been running institutions for 19 years. And he said, yeah, and if you keep up, you wind up in one. very typical response.
Very typical response. Well, is the Lincoln Museum now over in Springfield, you know, not far from where we are, is that sort of the creme de la creme of presidential libraries these days?
Yeah. I think it's certainly the largest, the most elaborate, the most...
and it should maybe in some ways.
Well, of course. It's unlike the others. It is not afraid to use, modern technology, narrative storytelling, all sorts of... Some people have called it Disney-esque, mm-hmm. as if that was an insult. The fact is... it's based on rigorous historical research. I think what it is accessible. Mm-hmm. I mean, the greatest thing about that job when I was there getting the place open was to watch kids, mm-hmm. come in mm-hmm. and to see them connect with these three-dimensional, immersive, more than just hands-on history. And I'll say the ultimate test of a successful museum is it sends you out the door wanting to know more.
Yeah.
And that's what the Lincoln does. Can I get one quick thing I have to hopefully point out? Because although I put my library days behind me, I'm nearing the end of a 13-year epic in the making, a biography of Nelson Rockefeller, which will be published
I knew you were
next
right.
year.
I was going to ask you about that. Next year you're
next
coming
year
out with
that.
Next year
on the 50th anniversary of the Rockefeller-Goldwater fight.
Wow.
And the other thing is, and I mention this only because I derive no pecuniary benefit from it, but people do ask from time to time of C-SPAN viewers, I'm leading two tours this year.
During the break, I was just talking to our producer, Steven Steigman, about the fact you lead these tours. I've always just been would kill to go on one of those things with you.
Well,
tell us
about
that.
I'll tell you, for people, we're doing in June, we're doing an 8-day Mr. Lincoln's War. Mm-hmm. Which is 15 Civil War sites, Lincoln sites, in Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and the District of Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And then in October, we do our 5-star deluxe, 11 presidents in 9 days of New York, the Hudson Valley, and New England at the peak of fall foliage.
Oh, boy.
And it's all historic hotels. And anyway, it's the deluxe. Everything we've learned over 20 years is in this trip.
Well, you are speaking to me in a very meaningful way here, Richard. I would just kill to go on one of those things.
If anyone has any curiosity, they can go to a website. It's all one word. It's called presidentsandpatriotstours.com. And you'll find out all the information about those trips.
We'll put that on our website. And again, Richard Norton Smith speaks this evening at 7:30 at the Dole Institute over at KU. The subject, John Adams. He'll be speaking about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington in the days ahead. All that information is on our website, kcur.org. And Richard, you know what a pleasure it always is to have you on the show. Thanks for taking the time with us.
The pleasure's all mine. Thank you, Steve.
You bet. That's Richard Norton Smith.